Radio's greatest application is in broadcasting mass entertainment. Probably one of the best ways to get started is to make it a hobby and build an amateur station. It will show you more quickly than anything else whether or not you can succeed in radio.
ABOO, Portland.
We are proud to announce exciting news. KBOO Community Radio has been voted the best radio station in Portland by Willamette Week readers. In June, Willamette Week held a citywide poll to celebrate the businesses, people, and events that make Portland special. Thanks to your votes, KBOO took first place for 2025. We couldn't have done it without you. For over 55 years, KBOO has filled a need that other media can't, amplifying the voices of the unserved and underserved communities and offering a platform for stories and sounds you won't hear anywhere else. Our news and public affairs programming centers voices and perspectives that are often ignored, voices rooted in peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, and social change. KBOO's music and arts programming, from the traditional to the experimental, reflects the diverse cultures and creative expressions of our community. KBOO has been boldly and independently broadcasting since 1968. We'll keep going as long as you keep listening. Thank you for voting. Thank you for supporting. Thank you for making KBOO your community radio station. Listener supported, volunteer powered, and award winning.
Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the government of Haiti, big business, and the blossoming illegal drug trade. Flashpoint senior producer Kevin Pina reports on how businessmen who refuse to play ball with the traffickers are no longer able to get their products shipped. And we'll feature our weekly news report from the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barris-Friedman. Nora reports that genocide continues amidst the endless slaughter of journalists and oftentimes their entire family. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're coming to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA in the Bay Area. And we begin with Haiti. Well, businessmen are now learning in terms of doing business in Haiti and the region. If they don't, participate with the traffickers, don't agree to carry their products, they ain't going to carry yours. And again, joining us is our senior producer, Kevin Pina, who knows a great deal about Haiti and the region. And Kevin, we're happy to have you back. I know you're in SoCal somewhere, but right now you're right with us, and we're happy to have you with us. Let's begin, though, here to set the scene, starting in 1991, because the United States government, with their coup and their destabilization policies around Haiti, have set this up so the traffickers are in the good stead with the government of Haiti. Lay this out for us.
Well, it's pretty clear that in the 90s, prior to Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide, in the late 80s, prior to Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide's first election in December 1990, that Pablo Escobar had already begun some operations and connections with specific members of Haiti's wealthy oligarchy and families, particularly a family known as the Deeb family. Joel Deeb was a close friend of Pablo Escobar, but Joel Deeb also had a history with U.S. intelligence and the CIA, who tried to actually at one point use Joel Deeb to get Escobar to hide out from the FBI in Haiti. apparently that plan never came to fruition. But ultimately, when Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected, he had promised to work with the DEA, had promised to try to create better relations between the Haitian
police. You need
police.
To repeat that. We lost you there for a minute. You need to just go back a sentence. I'm sorry, we did lose you for a moment, but come back to us.
Well, what I said is that Escobar had been doing business in and around Haiti in the late 80s before Aristide was elected, and that he was close to Joel Deeb, which is one of the families in Haiti, members of the wealthy elite in that country. And Joel Deeb was once used, the CIA once attempted to use him to lure Pablo Escobar to Haiti. Apparently that never came to fruition, but the point is that these relationships preceded Aristide's election in 1990. Then Aristide, of course, promised that he was going to work more closely to try to stop drug trafficking. Many people consider that coup against him in September of 1991 a cocaine coup, because we then saw that it was the Haitian military command that had overthrown him, led the Haitian brutal military in that coup d'etat. And it would later come out that, of course, that military high command, the majority of its members had been on the CIA payroll for more than a decade. And it really was that same organization that then worked with the up-and-coming Cali cartel after Escobar's assassination to transform Haiti into the primary or the major transshipment point of cocaine from the cartels in Colombia to the United States. Of course, you know, there's a lot of details in that. There's also Balaguer, who was the president of the DR, the Dominican Republic at that time. If you do a little bit of research, you'll see that there were a lot of reports coming about the Dominican Republic and its military and its government, the Balaguer government, being involved or suspected of complicity with cocaine trafficking and cartels. So there's this long-term relationship between the cartels, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic and its government. Balaguer was seen as the banker. Cedras, who you might remember, who was the general who led the coup, was sort of the mouthpiece. Michel Francois, who was the brutal chief of police of that time, was seen as the muscle. And General Philippe Biambi was in charge of shipping and transportation. I know that because I actually spent a lot of time with children of those military officers out in the clubs, the nightclubs, got a sense of their operation. Those guys like to talk a lot, and through that I got a sense of how that whole operation was set up and operated and who was responsible for which parts of it. And then, of course, you've only seen it increase, but it has never stopped. That's the point, is that the cartels hold on Haiti, using southern Haiti to drop product, then using different parts, other parts, remote parts of the country to create small airstrips to then break up parcels and or break them up and put them in small speedboats. It is a huge operation that has been going on for decades, Dennis. And we know that it's still continuing because, as you said, I've had the opportunity to interview several U.S. business people who have done business in the past and have given up because they simply can't get around the cartels, and some who are still trying despite the obstacles.
Now, we know that the United States government was well aware of this. We know that because we interviewed a drug czar in Haiti who was desperate to call attention to this emerging drug trade, and the United States turned a blind eye. Why would the U.S. turn a blind eye to this emerging drug trade?
Well, you know, that's always been the big question. You know, there's been plenty written speculating that, and you know, just a lot of evidence that seems to point to the fact that the CIA at one point, particularly after Escobar was killed and the Cali cartel rose to prominence, really changed its approach from attacking the cartels to then attempting to control them through infiltration and or buying specific of its specific individuals within it in order to influence the outcome, that they had sort of come to the conclusion they couldn't destroy it, So they could only hope to control it by infiltrating it. But what that meant was they at that point tacitly agreed to be involved in the trafficking themselves. Now, remember, we're talking about a business that creates, generates billions and billions of dollars of untraceable cash every year. And Haiti is at the center of it. Patrick Ely, who you referred to, certainly tried to alert the DEA, had contacts with the CIA as well, and was frustrated by the fact that it was clear they knew exactly what was going on, but that when it came to actually cooperating with Haitian officials and with Haitian law enforcement, which is his own problem, has its own problems with the cartels, that largely they were uncooperative, and that he was really just a voice shouting at the wind at the end of it. He said that to me several times. I felt like a voice shouting in the wind. There was nobody listening.
And we know it wasn't just the knowledge that the CIA had. They decided, and we started tracking this back in the mid-80s when the CIA decided to use traffickers, when they couldn't get, for instance, the U.S. government to participate in trying to undermine and overthrow the Nicaraguan government. They funded secret operations through the use of drugs to overthrow the Sandinista government. And we did major reporting on this. This also brought Gary Webb, people might remember the Dark Alliance and the San Jose Mercury News, and Gary Webb breaking the story about deep engagement of the CIA in using drug money to carry out covert operations. But back to Haiti in the 90s, leading up to the moment.
You're talking about the same period, Dennis. You're talking about the 90s. You're talking about the same period. Right.
That's right.
But when we're talking about the coup in Haiti, we're talking about, you know, that was just a few years earlier, right? It just bleeds right That's into right. the next beat, which is Haiti. You're right.
Yes. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacific Radio. We're speaking with our senior correspondent, Kevin Pina, and we're talking about an emerging, we could even say a blossoming drug trade in which essentially after the United States destabilized Haiti, kidnapped the president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, they opened up the doors to a whole bunch of thugs who are now in the government controlling the drug trade. Talk about you have been interviewing businessmen, some who have been participating, some who haven't, in dealing with the drug trade through the leadership in Haiti. Talk about the role that the current corrupt Haitian government is playing with businessmen and making them offers they, if you will, cannot refuse.
Well, but if it's okay, before we do that, I want to talk about the second coup against Aristide in 2004, because that's also considered by many in the know as a cocaine coup. That many of the same forces that were confronting Jovenel Moïse for his assassination in July 3 years back were really the same people that had been behind the 1991 coup and the 2004 coup. Remember, Haiti's elite, which sort of has always been given a carte blanche support, given carte blanche support by U.S. foreign policy. Remember, this is across Democratic administrations, Democratic Party administrations, and Republican presidents as well. They have always seen that elite as representing the best chance for partnerships that are going to guarantee the outcome of what the United States would like to see in Haiti. So maybe not so ironically, what we have seen is that those same members of those wealthy families have been intricately involved with Colombian cartels, with hiding not only the product as it gets shipped amongst their various products that they export, but also have been intricately involved in developing a very sophisticated banking network and money laundering network involving bankers and government officials in the Dominican Republic as well. So it's a system that's been created and developed over decades between these various forces on the island of Hispaniola, between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, that involve members of governments, that involve members of the Dominican military, members of both police forces and security forces. And remember that all of these security forces throughout all of this period have received money and training, not only from the Pentagon and Southcom, but through various programs in the region, and not just anti-drug programs, but also anti-terrorism programs and direct military assistance and training through the Pentagon. So and also infiltration by the CIA, quite frankly, in those forces. I could point to innumerable examples of that, that there's really clear evidence of. But my point is that how could, you know, the big question has always been, and this is the one that Patrick Elliott asked, you know, how on earth can the United States, through these various institutions, have so much inside of each of those other institutions, inside of the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and not know that this relationship of the cartels in Colombia, basically holding the population of that island hostage, especially the Haitian people, right? We're talking about 12 million souls today held hostage by a wealthy elite, U.S. foreign policy, and these cartels. There's no way that U.S. agencies do not know exactly what's going on. It's impossible for them not to know, Dennis, and that's part of the tragedy of this. So if we look at 1991, if we look at 2004, and then if we look at the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, just a few years ago, and his, of course, we know that those men who were extradited by the U.S., they were DEA informants, they were FBI CIs, confidential informants. Several of them were also connections to the CIA, and the fact that the CIA requested that the transcripts of their trials, now these are the gentlemen who've been accused of the assassination of the president, Jovenel Moïse, and I just told you their connections to various three-letter U.S. agencies, the CIA requested, and it was approved by the judge, that all of their transcripts be sealed in the name of national security. Now remember, all this is in the context of Jovenel Moïse himself having said, I have a list of those members of the wealthy elite who are working directly with the cartels, and he threatened a week before he was killed to release that list. So there's a lot of evidence pointing to background of what we're about to talk about now, which is today in Haiti, U.S. business people, some who have been forced out, who say they simply cannot do business in Haiti because every time they attempt to, the cartels approach them and try, and either will use strong arm tactics, out and out threats, or will use their cutouts in the Haitian government or the Haitian police to say, you either play ball, let us use your product and let us use your business for cover, or you don't do business in Haiti. I mean, I can give you an example.
Go on, just let me let people know you're speaking with Kevin Pina. He is our senior producer at Flashpoints. We're talking about, the intermingling of the U.S. government, U.S. agents, and high levels of the drug trade. And, of course, they now control the government of Port-au-Prince, of Haiti.
I have one person that I interviewed recently this past week. Made it really clear that he had attempted under Marta Lee to make huge investments. He'd put together a consortium of business people in the United States and Europe who were interested in specific products in Haiti and developing that business. They made investments of tens of millions of dollars to begin to get it off of the ground. And Marta Lee's hand-picked guys went to him when he was there and basically said, you're going to let us put this in your product, you're going to play ball with us, or we're going to stop everything that you're doing here in Haiti, you're going to lose your entire investment. And he basically told them no, but has since, you know, worked really hard to try to come back to do business in Haiti, but says it's impossible. And then when I asked him, is there any, you know, do you think the U.S. Embassy knew what was going on? He said, absolutely. There's no way they could. As a matter of fact, he told them. He's complained to the State Department. They said the State Department was part of the problem, that the State Department basically admitted it was helpless to do anything because there were higher ups above them even who would not allow them to intervene. Imagine, on behalf of U.S. businesses trying to do legitimate business in Haiti. It's an astounding story, Dennis.
Absolutely. Talk a little bit about, just to be specific, how the drug trade, how the drug cartel would use businessmen. Essentially what you're saying, if I understand correctly, is if you don't do the business of the cartel, you also don't get your own products shipped and distributed. Talk about how that works.
Well, you know, what they want to do is they want to use your product to put in their product. And apparently they're very crafty, and they've got chemists, and they've got, you know, engineers, and apparently they figured, you know, that they've got people whose lives apparently are devoted to doing just that. And, you know, immense capital, you know, a bottomless well of capital to figure it out. And so whatever you do, if it involves import-export, immediately they're on your back. They're going to be trying to find a way to use your product in order to piggyback their own. And if you don't agree to do it, you have no recompense. You can go to the U.S. government, you go to the State Department, you can knock on their door, you can ask for help, and you're not going to get it. That's what I was told. I've knocked on their door, I have tried everything I possibly could to get help, to go around this, and I simply can't. I'm no longer doing business in Haiti.
So say you're shipping liquid products or whatever, or various kinds of cargo. How precisely do they work? Do they say, we want, we are going to use one fifth of your carriage space to put our product in? We're going to hide our product underneath your product. How does that work?
Well, I mean, I was given some details, but I, without getting into the specifics, which would, you know, get some folks in trouble. I don't want to get into those specifics. But as I said, I was told that these folks have experts whose job it is to do nothing but figure out ways to do that. The point is that. We know who their representatives are on the ground. I mean, clearly, you know, the person who I said complained and named names of specific people in the Haitian government and in the Haitian police who approached him and or threatened him to the State Department, and nothing was done about it. You know, and he was told point blank, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, this involves something bigger than us. So what that alludes to, I'm not sure, but I can certainly guess, and I think that it goes back to this relationship we spoke to earlier, of complicity between the CIA and cocaine cartels in Colombia, and the way that they had approached, after the killing of Pablo Escobar, how to mitigate the trade by getting involved in the trade. And then, of course, we know that that was preceded, as you had said quite clearly, about clear collusion, where there was cocaine was involved in supplying the Contras inside of Nicaragua. So, and Haiti, of course, as I said, had been part of that network as well prior to Aristide's election. So, the difficulty is knowing or not knowing who to turn to. That was the clear frustration of the people that I interviewed, that they feel abandoned by officials in their own embassy, in their own government, when they believe that they're honest business people who are merely trying to create business opportunities in Haiti that would help the Haitian people, and that they're discovering that it's impossible to conduct any kind of honest business in Haiti without getting a knock on the door from representatives or Haitians who are representing the cartels in Haiti. And of course, we know that the gangs today, the Vivre Ensemble gangs, we know that Izzo is involved in shipping and transportation for the cartels. We know that Vita L'Homme and Le Mot Saint Jour are also involved in that trade. You know, and it gets a little more nefarious and interesting than that when you consider that, you know, now you've got Eric Prince on the field, right? You've got Blackwater fame, and we know that Eric Prince has had a long relationship with the CIA, particularly in Afghanistan. And, you know, Eric Prince, in exchange for his cleaning up the gangs, is now demanding that he also be allowed a long-term contract to oversee tax collection of goods that pass between the Haitian and Dominican border, where that's where a lot of the trade happens, Dennis. That's where a lot of the trafficking happens. So I don't know whether it's an accident that Prince is asking for that, but we do know what occurs. You know, the United Nations just released a report a few months back that said that the gangs are actually extorting nearly $100 million a year from the transport of goods between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, cargo containers. Well, you and I think most logical people know that you don't hide hundreds of millions of dollars under your bed or under your house. So it speaks to a larger network that's behind this, particularly if you consider, you know, that the gangs are involved in drug trafficking. If you consider that now Eric Prince is coming in and he's assisting the Haitian police, his ties to the intelligence community, and the fact that he's now asking to oversee one of the key transit points of that trafficking between across the island between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. You know, this story is yet to be fully understood and written, but I think we're beginning to see the clear outlines, not only of the history and background of the story, but also of what's beginning to emerge. And particularly, you know, I'll just say again, I think I said in this program once before, you know, Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, what, 4 or 5 months back, also rang out the alarm. He drew a picture directly from Catatumbo, Colombia, all the way up to the southern coast of Haiti. And he said, look, this is where the guns are now coming through. This is where the cocaine is coming through. This is why Haiti cannot get rid of these gangs right now, because there's simply too much money involved and too many people on the take and too many people getting wealthy on it, because the longer it goes on, the longer the trade continues, the more money goes into a lot of pockets.
Kevin, we only have a minute or two left, but just talk for a minute about the implications. What does this mean to everyday life on the ground in Haiti, to the suffering that we see emerging over the last several years?
Well, it's been a part of that suffering. It's been behind political instability. You know, we often say that Haiti's elite, which are the sort of the handmaidens of U.S. foreign policy in Haiti, you know, committed all these coups, 60 coups, just innumerable coups, and committed violence, and have controlled these monopolies. Well, largely those monopolies are staples, beans, rice, and sugar, and, you know, things that they force, you know, the Haitian people can't buy anywhere else. Well, that's worth a lot of money, but what's worth more money is what's being mixed into those products when it's shipped to other areas outside of Haiti. It's a population that's been held hostage, not only to a corrupt, wealthy elite supported by the United States government historically, but also to a wealthy elite that has been in bed with the cartels and has been protected, is being accused of being protected by certain specific U.S. agencies. So it's directly, it has created direct suffering of the masses of those people, particularly when you see that Aristide was a victim twice of those same forces, and he was trying to create the first safety net for the majority of the poor of that country. I can go into the details of that. You probably heard me do that on this program as well, but the point is that, you know, that was destroyed. It would not be allowed to occur because it challenged those U.S. proxies on the ground who have traditionally held sway and control over Haiti's politics and economy. And Haiti's politics and economy have for decades been a cover for Colombian cartels. That's the story.
Amazing. Well, we're going to leave it right there for now. Kevin Pina, senior producer for Flashpoints. We've been doing this story for some time. We really appreciate your courage and the good work you've been doing on this. Much more to come. Be safe. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Dennis.
You are absolutely welcome. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and we're going to continue with our reporting on the situation in Gaza, where Netanyahu, with the extraordinary support of the United States government, with the most vicious weaponry, the fighter jets, the big bombs, the 2,000-pound bombs, and even bigger than that, that they are still dropping on the Palestinian people in Gaza. And Netanyahu has declared, it's obvious what he's up to. He's trying to purge the entire Gaza Strip, either force them out one way or the other, and take over the land. I guess Trump is still dreaming about that that resort he wants to open up on the... He loves waterfront. He loves that waterfront. Anyway, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back to introduce the Electronic Intifada. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and as we do every Thursday, and this is a particularly bloody situation, we introduce the Electronic Intifada newscast with Nora Barrows Friedman. This is troubling. Listen to this.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 678 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombed and attacked areas across Gaza this week, killing at least 564 Palestinians and injuring nearly 3,100 between August 6th and August 13th, according to official records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. The number of casualties among starving people trying to access food aid has increased to nearly 1,900 killed and approximately 13,600 injured since May 27th, when Israel and the U.S. opened its private so-called aid distribution sites, opening fire on crowds every day since. On Wednesday, Israeli forces killed at least 100 Palestinians, the health ministry reported, including 61 in attacks in Gaza City, as Israel's destruction of northern Gaza intensifies. 37 starving people were killed on Wednesday while trying to obtain food aid. An airstrike in the Zeitoun neighborhood of Gaza City on August 11th killed an entire family, the only survivor being a young girl named Lorin An-Nadim, who was trapped beneath the rubble, pinned against a mattress that Lorin said was her parents' bed. The Palestinian Civil Defense recorded her rescue. That's from the civil defense on August 11th. Their spokesperson, Mahmoud Basal, said that air raids on Gaza City have been steadily intensifying for days, as the Israeli army is using bombs, drones, and highly explosive munitions that cause massive destruction to residential buildings. The civil defense stated earlier this week that one of its firefighters was killed in his family's tent shelter in Al-Mawasi in central Gaza. More than 135 rescue workers with the civil defense have been killed over the past 22 months. Israel's escalations of attacks in Gaza City this week killed at least 7 children in a single airstrike on a building in the Zeitoun neighborhood on Sunday, August 10th. In an extremely graphic video, the bodies of 7 small children, most of whom appear to be babies and toddlers, lay bloodied and strewn on the floor at a hospital as family members mourned over them. Later that evening on August 10th, Israel directly attacked a journalist tent in the courtyard of El Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, assassinating 6 broadcast reporters and photojournalists as Israel's hunting and targeted killings of high-profile witnesses to its crimes of genocide continue with impunity. Al Jazeera's Anas Al-Sharif, a 28-year-old reporter who millions in Palestine and around the world relied on every day for his coverage, was killed alongside the network's correspondent Mohamed Kareka, their cameramen Ibrahim Zahir and Mohamed Nofal, journalists Mu'amin Aliwa and Mohamed Al-Khaldi, and Saad Jundia, a Palestinian civilian who happened to be present. This clip was recorded just moments after the airstrike, when friends and colleagues of the reporters and their community realized that they had been killed. They tried to retrieve the journalists' shredded bodies as their clothes were still on fire. That was filmed just moments after the airstrike on the journalist's tent at Al-Shifa Hospital. Just 3 weeks ago, Anas Al-Sharif's appeal to all international press freedom and human rights organizations to do something to intervene against renewed threats against him by the Israeli military. He stated on July 23rd, quote, "Once again, the Israeli army spokesperson has launched a campaign of threats and incitement against me because of my work as a journalist with Al Jazeera. I reaffirm I, Anas Al-Sharif, am a journalist with no political affiliations. My only mission is to report the truth from the ground as it is, without bias." Al-Sharif's friend and fellow reporter Ibrahim Nofal, whose brother Mohammed was killed in the airstrike on August 10th, had filmed Anas Al-Sharif reacting to the video of Israeli military spokesperson Avichai Adrai, who openly threatened Al-Sharif on social media. Anas watches the video on a phone, in a tent, surrounded by his colleagues. He says, quote, "I really don't know, Ibrahim, what this guy wants from me. He wants me to stop covering the news. He wants me to stop covering the massacres that are happening. Despite that, I will continue until my last breath. Whether he threatens me or wants to bomb me, the mission will continue until the last breath, God willing. God willing, we are not afraid." Anas Al-Sharif and his colleagues who were murdered on August 10th in their tent at Al-Shifa Hospital are 6 of at least 238 reporters and media workers killed by the Israeli army as the world powers and international agencies continue to fail the Palestinians of Gaza nearly 2 years into this genocide. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that Israel, quote, has turned its horrific 22-month war on the Gaza Strip into a slaughterhouse for Palestinian journalists, systematically targeting them and their workplaces in an effort to enforce a total media blackout across the enclave. Anas Al-Sharif's final broadcast for Al Jazeera aired earlier in the day, focused on tiny children who were suffering from Israel's deliberate starvation policy. Al-Sharif, wearing his press vest and helmet, reported from a Gaza City hospital and told the stories of each child in the ward in a harrowing 4-minute report. Later that evening, Al-Sharif posted the following, quote, "The occupation is threatening to invade Gaza seriously, and the city has been bleeding for 22 months under the fire of land, sea, and air. Its martyrs number in the tens of thousands and its wounded in the hundreds of thousands. And if this madness does not stop, nothing will remain of Gaza but rubble, and the image and voice of its people will fade away, and history's memory will record you as silent witnesses to a genocide crime that no one did anything to stop. Minutes before he was killed, Anas al-Sharif posted 13 seconds of video of heavy bombing in Gaza City. He captioned this clip, quote, "Relentless bombardment. For 2 hours, the Israeli aggression has intensified on Gaza City." Two days earlier, on Friday, August 8th, Anas al-Sharif documented an airstrike on homes in western Gaza City. While he was being hunted by the Israelis and while the Israeli government announced that they were planning to intensify their obliteration of northern Gaza. Quote, "Night and day, the Israeli raids on Gaza do not stop," he wrote. "And this is one of them, just moments ago, targeting a house west of Gaza City." In April of this year, just days after Israel assassinated his colleague, 23-year-old Hossam Shabat, in a targeted drone strike, Anas al-Sharif wrote his last will and testament to be published upon his death. I'll read excerpts of it here. "This is my will and my final message. If these words reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me and silencing my voice. God knows I gave every effort and all my strength to be a support and a voice for my people ever since I opened my eyes to life in the alleys and streets of the Jabalia refugee camp. My hope was that God would extend my life so I could return with my family and loved ones to our original town of occupied Ascalon, Al-Majdal. But God's will came first and his decree is final. I have lived through pain in all its details, tasted suffering and loss many times, yet I never once hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification, so that God may bear witness against those who stayed silent, those who accepted our killing, those who choked our breath, and whose hearts were unmoved by the scattered remains of our children and women, doing nothing to stop the massacre that our people have faced for more than a year and a half. I entrust you with Palestine, the jewel in the crown of the Muslim world, the heartbeat of every free person in this world. I entrust you with its people, with its wronged and innocent children who have never had the time to dream or live in safety and peace. Their pure bodies were crushed under thousands of tons of Israeli bombs and missiles, torn apart and scattered across the walls. I urge you not to let chains silence you, nor borders restrain you. Be bridges toward the liberation of the land and its people until the sun of dignity and freedom rises over our stolen homeland. I entrust you to take care of my family. I entrust you with my beloved daughter Shem, the light of my eyes, whom I never got the chance to watch grow up as I had dreamed. I entrust you with my dear son Salah, who I had wished to support and accompany through life until he grew strong enough to carry my burden and continue the mission. I entrust you with my beloved mother, whose blessed prayers brought me to where I am, whose supplications were my fortress and whose light guided my path. I also entrust you with my lifelong companion, my beloved wife, Salah Bayan, from whom the war separated me for many long days and months. Yet she remained faithful to our bond, steadfast as the trunk of an olive tree that does not bend, patient, trusting in God, and carrying the responsibility in my absence with all her strength and faith. I urge you to stand by them, to be their support after God Almighty. If I die, I die steadfast upon my principles. Do not forget Gaza, and do not forget me in your sincere prayers for forgiveness and acceptance." Condolences and messages of grief and love poured in from Anas al-Sharif's colleagues, from friends, and from people across Gaza and around the world. Reporter Ahmed al-Najjar in Khan Yunis told Al Jazeera on Tuesday that the targeted airstrike on the agency's staff was the most devastating loss Gaza's journalist community has faced. Journalist Salah al-Jafarawi mourned Anas al-Sharif and posted this video of their reunion during the so-called ceasefire in January of this year. That was from journalist Saleh Al-Jafarawi. Anas Al-Sharif, 28 years old, was buried in Gaza City along with his colleagues. Mohammed Koreka, a correspondent for Al Jazeera who was also killed in the airstrike on the reporter's tent at Al-Shifa Hospital, was the only son of his parents. In 2024, Israeli forces executed his mother, who sought shelter and medicine at Al-Shifa Hospital during the second assault on the compound, according to his colleague Nur Oda. Mohammed was killed a few steps away from the crime scene of his mom's murder, Oda said. Koreka was described by his wife as extremely devoted to his mother, to his children, and to her. Quote, "We were unnaturally close," she said. "He spent his time between his work and his home. He dedicated his life to his wife and children. Mohammed and Anas had a very strong relationship, but we never expected them to meet the same end." Meanwhile, as Israel slaughters professional eyewitnesses to its crimes, Western and regional states continue to send lethal airdropped parcels of food aid instead of forcing Israel to open the crossings to the 22,000 aid trucks that remain blocked. On Saturday, August 9th, an airdropped box fell on a child in central Gaza, killing him instantly. The day before, on August 8th, an aid parcel landed on top of people and severely injured 19-year-old Karam Al-Kahlout as he was trying to obtain water for his disabled father. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's civil defense, standing at the teenager's bedside in the hospital, called for stopping the airdrops and instead ensure aid delivery through official crossings, quote, "in a safe and organized manner, guaranteeing it reaches those in need without endangering civilians' lives. This is what we've been warning about since the Israeli occupation agreed to the Arab countries' airdrops to Gaza," Bassal stated. The Gaza government media office stated on August 9th that at least 23 Palestinians have been killed and 124 wounded from these airdrops since the beginning of the genocide. Euromed Human Rights Monitor released statistics on the exact amount of aid that has been dropped so far. From July 26th to August 11th, only 1,218 aid packages were dropped onto Gaza, the human rights group stated. Quote, "Gaza's actual need is around 600 trucks of aid every single day to stop famine and begin recovery. Over 17 days, that equals to 10,200 trucks. Since one truckload equals 30 airdropped packages, Gaza requires about 18,000 packages each day. The 1,218 packages dropped in that period equal just 40.6 truckloads in total, or an average of only 2.4 trucks per day, a mere 0.4% of what is actually needed. At this rate, it would take 250 days of airdrops to deliver the same amount of aid Gaza requires in a single day," Euromed said. However, Denmark, in coordination with the United Arab Emirates and Jordan, announced that it would start participating in lethal airdrops, joining the UK, Canada, France, and Spain, among other countries who have decided to turn to public relations management instead of physically stopping Israel's genocide, starvation, and siege on Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli forces at the Gaza boundary crossings and Israeli and American mercenary forces operating the private so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites continue to trap, injure, and kill starving Palestinians every day. Doctors Without Borders released a report this week titled, "This is not aid, this is orchestrated killing," which draws on medical data, patient testimonies, and firsthand medical witnessing, quote, "to demonstrate that what has been branded as aid distribution is in fact a system of institutionalized starvation and dehumanization." Joining similar calls by Palestinian civil society and United Nations agencies, the human rights group called for the immediate dissolution of the GHF distribution mechanism and urged states and private donors to refrain from funding what is essentially a death trap. And Israeli forces continue to target starving Palestinians at crossings in northern Gaza, who try to obtain limited amount of food aid and those who are working to protect the aid from armed Israel-backed gangs. Euromed Monitor's Maha Husseini reported on Wednesday that an Israeli airstrike targeted a group of security personnel, killing 12 and injuring dozens more. Husseini said that, quote, for weeks, aid has been looted by armed gangs operating under the protection of Israeli forces. Gangs are allowed to access areas where regular citizens are barred. Security personnel were deployed today, Wednesday, to protect aid and ensure it reached UN and international organizations' warehouses. They have now been targeted again, she said. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza reported on Wednesday that it recorded 8 deaths due to starvation in a 24-hour period, including 3 children. This brings the total number of victims of Israel's starvation to 235, including 106 children. Reporter Moaz Abutaha interviewed Dr. Ahmed Al-Fara at Nasser Medical Complex this week, who talked about his 2-year-old patient, Sham Koide, who weighs just 4 kilograms, less than 9 pounds.
Sham is 2 years old. Now she's in the hospital. Her weight is just 4 kilograms. Her weight should be 12 kilograms. She lost nearly 8 kilograms from her actual weight. She's complaining from severe acute malnutrition. As we can see, she just have the skin over the bone. The muscles are lost. The fat tissue is lost. She's dehydrated. She has sunken eyes. She's apathic, she's irritable, she's anxious. She has severe distended abdomen, she has hepatomegaly. She has signs of rickets due to vitamin D deficiency, rachitic rosary, still open anterior fontanelle, irritability, wide broadening of the lower limbs and the upper limbs. So she need to evacuate it outside as soon as possible to be diagnosed.
That was Dr. Ahmed Al-Fara at the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. Mohammed Zakout, Gaza's director of general hospitals, told Al Jazeera Arabic that, quote, these cases will soon be in the thousands if nothing changes. Children are among the weakest and most vulnerable to malnutrition. We have no treatments to save them, not even intravenous feeding, which is used in emergency cases like those we are seeing now. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight the story of the last date in Gaza by Asim al-Nabi, writing from Gaza City. Quote, it's just a date, a single 4-centimeter piece of dried fruit. But here in Gaza, where nothing comes easily and everything holds meaning, even a date becomes a symbol of endurance, sacrifice, and love. I kept this date for 6 months. I'd found it and saved it for what I imagined would be the darkest days, the days when food would disappear from the shelves, when starvation would wrap itself around our lives, when sharing even a crumb would become an act of resistance. Those days are now. No one in my family wanted to eat the last date and deny someone else its sweetness. That's who we are in Gaza, not just survivors, but givers. We give even what little we have left. Not because we are saints, but because love and dignity are all we can hold on to when everything else has been taken from us. War can reveal the worst in people. Here in Gaza, it also brings out the best. Our streets are filled with pain and rubble, but also with kindness. Small gestures like passing along a date speak volumes about who we are. Some may say it's just a date, but I see in it the whole of Gaza's story, deprivation and generosity, despair and defiance, the tight knots of family and the unwillingness to surrender to cruelty. This date, saved and shared, is a tiny act of rebellion in the face of a system trying to strip us of everything, even the right to nourish our children. In Gaza, we have redefined wealth. Wealth is not what you hoard, but what you give away, and is measured in the strength of the bonds that hold families and neighbors together. In a world that tries to reduce us to statistics, we have become storytellers. A single date carries the story of a family's love, a child's survival, a father's absence, and a people's refusal to stop being human. People ask how we survive, how we keep going when the bombs keep falling, when hunger gnaws at our children, when there is no certainty that we'll live to see the next sunrise. My answer is, we survive for one another. We survive because in Gaza, no one wants to eat the last date. And we survive because we are all dreaming that a day might come soon with freedom and an abundance of dates. The date is gone now, eaten by a child too young to know what it means. But the act remains, rippling outward like a pebble cast into water. It is in these ripples, in the stories we tell, in the way we refuse to forget, that Gaza lives on. Those are excerpts from The Story of the Last Date in Gaza by Asim An-Nabi, writing from Gaza City on electronicintifada.net. Asim is a father, an engineer, and a PhD researcher, and serves as the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. A new assessment by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and the UN's Satellite Center revealed this week that 98.5% of cropland in the Gaza Strip is either destroyed, in no-go zones imposed by the Israeli military, or both. Palestinians have stewarded, cared for, and made fruitful the entirety of that land for millennia, of course. But in a tiny corner of the 1.5% of land that they can still access and reclaim for food production as Israel's starvation on Gaza accelerates, members of the Samir Project, a mutual aid organization in Gaza, recorded video of an abundance of cucumber and zucchini plants, along with tomatoes, growing in the sunshine across about 2.5 acres. This was the product of a collaboration between the Samir Project and the Arab Group for the Protection of Nature, an organization that aims to protect, sustain, and reestablish sovereignty over Palestine's natural resources and food. And finally, musician and music teacher Ahmed Mouin led a song with his students, using the incessant drones overhead as instruments. The song, "Carry It, Jamal, Carry It," Mouin says, is a call to lift the weight of truth, the voice of courage, and the spirit that refuses to be silenced.
Everyone, how are you? I miss you a lot, really. Today there's a lot of drones. I'm gonna sing a song today with drones. شيل يا جمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليلو وين وين عالظالمي وين وين ومن الله لا أسهر على نجوم الليل أنا نديلو شيل يا جمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليلو وين وين عالظالمي وين وين لا أسهر على نجوم الليل أنا نبيل شيل يا جمالي شيل يا حوطك بالغدا الشريط معطر بالليل يا ليل وين وين عالظالمي وين 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 لا أسهر على نجوم الليل أنا نبيل شيل يا جمالي شيل يا حوطك بالغدا الشريط معطر بالليل
is Ahmed Mouin with his students, and that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
And that does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Mr. No, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.